From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump gives his first State of the Union address tonight, and we're going to hear now from both parties, starting with Congressman Mike Johnson, a Republican representing Louisiana's 4th Congressional District. Congressman, welcome. And what do you want to hear from the president tonight?
I am hoping for a positive message that, as the White House said yesterday, will be encouraging and bipartisan in its tone. There's a lot to celebrate from the first year of the Trump administration. We've accomplished a lot in the first year. I think he's got a lot to tout, and I expect it'll be an uplifting message.
The president is also likely to talk about immigration, and last week he outlined an immigration overhaul that, among other things, would include a path to citizenship for as many as 1.8 million people in the country illegally. Is that something you're willing to vote for?
Not in its current form. Of course, the devil's in the details. But, you know, we've been concerned. I'm a conservative in the House. We've been concerned about how we handle the delicate DACA dilemma, as I call it. You know, we don't feel like it's appropriate to reward illegal immigration. It's not the answer, because if you create a special avenue to citizenship, it only encourages others to come here illegally. At the same time, I think all of us have great sympathy for those persons, and we've got to handle that very carefully. There are some good proposals on the table. We've been working on it in the House for months, and I hope we can get back to some of those reasonable suggestions.
Because these are people who didn't make the decision on their own to come into the United States. They were brought here illegally.
They were, and that's why, you know, I think that there's a wide consensus in the Congress that something has to be done for the DACA recipients. But, you know, the American people, I think, are consistent in their belief that we need a strong border, that we need to enforce our immigration laws so that they're meaningful, and that we send a message to the whole world that we really will abide by the rule of law here. I think that's an important thing for us to do.
What about the other message, though, that a wall, for example, would send to the rest of the world? Your colleague in the House of Representatives, Democrat Luis Gutierrez, said, "Why don't you just take your middle finger and point it at Mexico, because it's the same thing. I really don't believe that it's about security. It's about saying brown people stay out of the country."
Well, look, I think that hyperbole is totally misplaced. I think that there are people on both sides of the aisle who genuinely understand that a secure border is important for national security. It's important to maintain the rule of law. We know that there are dangerous criminals that are coming through the porous border, you know, the southern border as well as the northern border, for that matter. We have to address the problem and to do it in a way that's reasonable. I don't personally believe that a physical structure of a wall is necessary across the entire southern border, but there are parts that do need a physical wall, and we need to combine that with technology, drone technology, for example, that the border security agents say will get the job done. So, you know, I support the president's initiative on that. I think the majority of the Congress does, and I hope that it's a big piece of the immigration plan going forward.
Do you expect some sort of immigration plan to be agreed upon in the next couple of weeks and avoid another government shutdown?
Well, we hope so. You know, as I mentioned, there was a bipartisan working group that was advancing ideas through the process prior to, you know, the president's announcement, the White House announcement. I think there's a lot of good ideas on the table. I think we can come together and reach that consensus so that we don't face another government shutdown. I think everyone regrets when that happens, and it places good men and women, federal employees, and our military in a very unfortunate situation. I think we can avoid that.
One more thing you've no doubt heard. In fact, you've probably seen this memo prepared by Congressman Devin Nunes' staff. Have you read it, and do you think it should be made public?
I have read it, and I do believe that it should be released to the public. And the reason I believe that is because, you know, if we're going to maintain a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, as Lincoln famously said, it relies very much on transparency. And I think this summary can be released in a responsible manner that doesn't jeopardize national security interest in any way. And I think the people themselves should be able to draw their own conclusions and make their own decisions about it once they have the information.
What about the fact that the Justice Department does not agree with you on that? They don't think that this should be released.
I've heard those concerns. I think many of those concerns are overblown from what I've seen. You know, this is a summary of classified material. It's not the underlying material itself, and because of that, I think it could be released responsibly. If the Justice Department or key figures in the intelligence community felt that some parts should be redacted, you know, that's a possibility as well. I think the White House will take all of that under advisement and make the right decision.
Do you think that Robert Mueller is handling his job well?
I think as an individual, he's a man of great integrity. But I can tell you, as a member of the House Judiciary Committee, we've had multiple hearings over the last year trying to dig into the allegations of bias in that investigation. And some of the evidence, I'll tell you, is very compelling, that there have been at least some individuals involved in the process who clearly had a bias against the person and the administration that they were investigating. That's a real problem. And it raises some big questions about the integrity of the system.
That's Congressman Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Well, this past weekend, the Koch brothers also sang the praises of President Trump and his ability to carry out their conservative agenda, pledging to increase funding for midterm races to keep the gains made under Trump. And here are some Trump supporters from the BBC today.
Well, he's a man of action and incredible focus. He's got all of the establishment Republicans against him, all the Democrats against him, most of the media against him, and yet he just keeps zeroing in on that goal to make America great again.
He is saying what a lot of people were thinking. I mean, and I think he's cutting through the politics of it.
A lot of people don't like him tweeting. I think it's great because it's coming from his mouth to your ear.
That's Roger Oyen. Before that, his wife, Jan. And we started with Keith Krischer, all in Grant County, Wisconsin. So how do Democrats counter tonight? Democratic strategist Steve Shale joins us from WFSU in Tallahassee, Florida. Steve, are Democrats paying too much attention to Trump tweets while his backers can tick off what he's done?
Yeah, I mean, I think for many Democrats, the Trump election is still kind of a moment that people haven't moved past. And I think that's, frankly, a danger. And, you know, part of why he got there is he ran a pretty smart campaign. And I think when you see, for example, what the Koch brothers are looking at doing in 2018, a lot of the things that helped elect Donald Trump, a lot of the strategies behind it, the field effort, et cetera, was through the Koch funding. And so we have to take it seriously.
Oh, very seriously. The Koch brothers pledged this past weekend to increase by 60%. Their support of Republicans in the midterms to spend as much as $400 million to defend the policies that have been put in place. Let's just list some of them. The president appointed Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, signed the tax bill into law. By the way, liberal groups say that Koch Industries stand to save about $1 billion to $1.5 billion a year because of that tax cut. The president also withdrew from the Paris climate deal, declared Jerusalem the capital of Israel, pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He can brag tonight.
Yeah, but most of those accomplishments appeal to a very small sector of the electorate. You know, they talk to his base. You know, and you know the reason why the president has 40% approval rating is because 60% of the Americans don't necessarily agree with the direction he's taking the country. The challenge in midterm elections is these things tend to be more about motivation and turnout than they are about sort of winning the argument. And so I suspect the Koch brothers, when they look towards spending that money, what they traditionally do is not spend a lot of money on TV. They spend a lot of money on the ground, digital campaigns, identifying the types of voters who may be less motivated to vote normally, but through a message here or there or a door knock here or there can win.
Well, what about tonight? We hear that the president's speech is going to be a little more conciliatory than maybe his inaugural was, maybe extend some olive branches along with touting his achievements, which every president does. But what do you think the Democrats should say in response?
You know, I think, again, for Democrats, the goal is to continue to lay out what a different vision would look like, that it's not just that Trump is sort of a disaster on the world stage or sort of an embarrassment in the office. That going a different direction in 2018 and 2020 means more economic security for more people. It means a renewed sense of America's place in the world, not just as a military power, but as a power to do good. And so I hope when you hear the responses, that's the tack we're going to take. Because in the end, when we look towards the next big fight, which is 2020, it's going to be as much about our ability to lay out a vision for what America should look like as much as it's going to be a referendum on Trump's interesting behavior as president.
Well, how do you counter his pointing to the stock market as surging on his watch, the lowest unemployment for African-American men, these details that are happening now? How do you counter that?
Well, first of all, I mean, most of that economic take the unemployment happened under Obama. And if you look at polling, voters give President Obama credit because take African-American unemployment. It dropped from 15% to 7.5% under Obama. Trump gets credit for dropping in another point. But the reality, take the stock market. You know, 85% of Americans don't have a, you know, stock. And so those gains, which actually are less as a percentage than they were in Obama's first year, but that's besides the point. Those gains don't necessarily impact people's pocketbooks.
But they and think, but it impacts their mindset. It makes them feel that things are good.
It does, except at the same time when things like President Trump takes away their health care. And again, I think that our job is to lay out a vision about how a prosperity can be broader. I mean, a lot of the Trump policies are going to – they sound great and they nice little talking points. But the reality for most middle-class families, take like ones from my hometown in Kankakee, Illinois, there's really nothing that the increased stock market's doing to help reduce the cost of living and make life better for folks like that. Our job is to lay out that we do have a vision to get there.
That's Democratic strategist Steve Schell. Steve, thanks so much.
Hey, really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on.
So, yo, tonight's lesson is Latin history for morons. And that's you.
That's actor, playwright, comedian John Leguizamo in his latest one-man show, the new Broadway hit Latin History for Morons. And actually, when he first wrote it, he was referring to himself. The show is a 95-minute, no-holds-barred roller coaster ride through 3,000 years of Latino history, something he says has been largely erased from school books around the country, and something he discovered through painstaking research after he tried to find a Latino hero for his middle school son's school project. It was for the project, but also for the middle schooler who was relentlessly bullied because of his Latin heritage. Latin History for Morons tells of the boy's journey and the father's, while at the same time recreating characters from Andrew Jackson to Frida Kahlo to the Emperor Montezuma, taking hits at everyone and everything in between.
Why is all our art called folk art, and then all of European art is called fine art, and then modern art is just our folk art gentrified?
And the show is hitting home with audiences.
Wow, so I'm a Puerto Rican and a history teacher, so it meant a lot to me, and it was gives you a lot of pride to understand that we've been here for very many years, and we've fought in the American Revolution. I've been telling that to my kids for the longest time.
My mom's from Ecuador and my dad's Puerto Rican. There's a lot of pride. You know, it's a show, but at the same time, those issues are really evident in today's society.
We met up with John Leguizamo in New York during a break between shows to hear more about the reaction he's getting.
I do a book signing right after, and people share all their thoughts about how the play touched them. I got the 70-year-old Puerto Rican one from the Bronx who said she felt like a second-class citizen her whole life. Till the night of the show.
That's gonna feel good.
Oh, I felt it. Well, she made me cry. I was weeping at my book signing. I was like, that I'm pathetic. We've had a lot of kids come in, like young kids, 12, 13 year olds. And my director went to a school in the Bronx yesterday, and he talked to these kids, and the kids felt so inspired and so proud of being Latin from the show. Like the first time in their lives, in a way. Feeling so proud of, because you don't learn any of this in your history textbooks. I never learned about it.
Talk about your own son. It's just hard to imagine that there's a kid in 20 whatever we are in.
I agree.
Bullied for being Hispanic.
I know. It's ridiculous.
What would they say to him?
Well, there was a lot of Mexican references to him. You know, you're a beaner. You know, that kind of typical old school movie racism. But, you know, my son is half Colombian, half Puerto Rican, and half Jewish. He's a lot of, there's a lot of young man in there.
So you decide you're going to help him find some heroes for a class project.
Yes.
And they're going to be of his background.
I gave him the wrong information. I thought I knew things. And he goes and does the first part of the project. And, you know, he gets humiliated. And he says, I'm never going to trust you, Dad. What would you tell him? Well, I told him that the tribe that I came from was the Chibcha, and they'd made the gold for the Incas. And I thought it was all true, but I made a mistake. Chibcha was the language they spoke. The tribe was the Muisca. And he got corrected by his teacher, and, you know, he felt really humiliated. So I started doing more research to be authentic with him and to give him real, real facts. I didn't want to trip him up again.
Well, I'm assuming for you, too.
Well, it's incredible because as I'm helping my son, I'm realizing that I'm the one that's getting woke. I'm the one that's getting educated. Because, you know, I grew up here, and as a Latin man, I learned nothing about Latin contributions. Because other Latin people who grew up in their countries, they learn at least about heroes and the freedom fighters. But I had no knowledge, you know, I had nothing. And then when I'm reading all this information about our empires, you know, that the Incas had binary code that predated computers, that they pioneered socialism successfully before Karl Marx, that they were the largest empire in the world, three times bigger than the Ming Dynasty, three times bigger than Tsarist Russia. It's so empowering, and then you feel, wow, why was I cheated out of that? You feel a little bit betrayed.
So you put together all of this, and you start with, okay, so there's the Mayans.
Everybody knows that, right? 1000 BC, we had Mayans, and then we have now.
And then you draw a straight line across the board to Pitbull. You know, that's culture. That's it.
Well, that's the beginning of the play when I was a moron, and the audience is equally moronic with me until we get unmoronified. Yeah, I mean, that's how I felt like my whole education was. But the other crazy thing was then I found out that we participated in the making of America, bigly. We're the only ethnic group that has fought in every single war besides Native Americans.
Talk about the Revolutionary War.
10,000 unknown Latino patriots fought, and some of them were Puerto Rican, Cuban, Mexican-American, some Venezuelans. General Bernardo Galvez sent $70,000 worth of weapons to George Washington, and Cuban women in Virginia sold their jewelry to feed the patriots. So we also financed the war, so we too are the sons and daughters of the American Revolution, which is mind-boggling, and which was one of those facts that I found out that revolutionized my mind.
As you discover this, I'm sure there's anger. Where do you find the humor?
You're right. I mean, there's a lot of mixed feelings. I mean, like, all of life is always complex like that. I mean, there's a lot of sadness to see the destruction of all these great empires, the Aztecs, the Incas, and basically the most successful destruction of a people's culture, religion, and language in history. The biggest theft in history, 500,000 tons of gold was stolen from the Incas. You know, that you have to forgive and you have to move on, and you can't do it if you hold bitterness. You just can't.
And you also find the humor in the way you characterize some of these people. I mean, you're known for taking on every character. I was wondering, knowing you're taking on Montezuma, Ricky Ricardo, Frida Kahlo, I was wondering, is this making up for when I heard you tell Jorge Ramos, you're an NYU student, acting student, everybody else is getting all the job interviews, yeah. You're not. I'm wondering if that's part of what you make up for in your one-man plays.
That's funny. Taking all the roles that I couldn't get when I started out. I go to NYU. I study with the best acting teachers, just like all my friends. And all my white friends are going to 5 auditions a day, and I'm going to 1 every few months.
And it's for the drug dealer.
Right. And it's for some incredibly demeaning and putting a negative image on screen, which we don't need. Yeah, maybe I am. Maybe I am overcompensating for all those times, you know. It's possible. I mean, I do have a blast on stage. I mean, I really enjoy myself now. You know, Denzel Washington came down. He said, you know, this was the most important show he'd seen on stage in a long time. And, you know, it's striking other people, too. You know, I think it's a unifying show. It's not a divisive show.
So how did you come to Montezuma? Is just a slightly effeminate?
Well, you know, I did a lot of research, and then I didn't realize that there was some plays and books. They had made those same assumptions that I made. Because Moctezuma was captured by Cortez, and they lived in the palace.
Cortez from Spain came to conquer him, take over Mexico.
Thank you. See, she's not a moron. Moctezuma became sort of the puppet and colluded with Cortez against his own people. So, you know, there's always, and he killed him in his sleep, and it was all like very weird stuff that was going on that sounded kind of strangely homoerotic, so I brought it out even more.
Frida Kahlo, you have the unibrow.
Yeah. She comes in later in the play, more in my son's speech in junior high. When my son gets woke and gets a chance to get back at the bullies with all his information, he throws in Frida Kahlo as saying, I've got a lot of heroes in me. Cesar Chavez, the civil rights activist, Frida Kahlo, and Cespedes of the Mets, even though he's always injured.
Did that really happen? Did your son really get woke through your research and his knowing this history?
He was a woke young man in some ways. More in terms of dealing with the emotional abuse that he was dealing with. I mean, because it was incessant.
What do you think about the climate now and how it might be contributing to bullying?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that is a sad side effect of Trump publicly denigrating Mexican-Americans and taking down the bilingual page in the government site that's been up there for decades by putting quotas on legal immigrating Latin people and black people to this country. It sends a terrible message.
You know, I was wondering, do you ever think, John Leguizamo, of taking this show, taking it to places when people may not have met a person of Latin or Hispanic origin?
No.
Except, no, you would not do that.
No, I would not. No. I'm not a circus freak. I'm not an animal in a zoo to be looked at that way. You know, I'm not a social studies project. But I want to go where there's a mix, where there's Latin people and white people and black people and people of all colors. But I want a Latin group to be in there because they need to hear this. I'm having a blast. I am having a blast. Doing de Tocqueville is not for everybody, but I do Alexander de Tocqueville from the 1800s in my best French that I can.
Is he here now, by any chance?
Perhaps. I'm not a chasseur, but here we go. And, I do when he was talking to Congress about the pioneers coming here and the way they were treating Native Americans. You know, I didn't know how you Americans did. You like to exterminate Indians somehow.
Hey, your son... he's a teenager, so is he just so proud of you, or is he like, oh my God, Dad, did you have to do this?
He's like, he loved to play, but he's horrified by me because I'm too loud and too much. And I can't blame him. I mean, I'm just a lot of a dad.
Is he walking taller now?
I don't think he's really fully captured the message in the play about him, that it's a love letter to him, that he's my hero. But I think he will. I think it'll make sense to him later on in life. I know he feels very proud of it, and I know he's come to see it 3 times, and I know they tell me he laughs a lot, even though he doesn't always tell me.
How about you? Prouder? Walking taller? Or
absolutely, absolutely. The play revitalizes me. Carmen Yulín Cruz, the mayor of San Juan, came to my show. I mean,
and you feel what?
Oh my God! So honored and so proud and so just united in resistance. You know.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. What a blast. You're awesome.
John Leguizamo in New York. For more on his Broadway hit, Latin History for Morons, go to hereandnow.org.
Do you love trivia, puzzles, nerdy games, and humor? What about interviews with actors, musicians, and people from all walks of life? Yeah? Then join me, Ophira Eisenberg, host of NPR's Ask Me Another, every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Today, 3 major U.S. companies, Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, and JPMorgan Chase, announced a plan to work together to reduce healthcare costs for their combined 1.1 million employees. The 3 companies will create an independent organization to look specifically at how technology could help lower healthcare costs. The companies also say it will be free from profit-making incentives. Robin Farzad hosts Full Disclosure on NPR One. He joins us now with more on this. Hi, Robin.
Jeremy, how are you?
I'm doing well. And why do these companies want to get together on a project like this? And tell us more about it.
For starters, I mean, think about the signaling. It's pretty much like shock and awe to insurers and drug makers. Here you have the wealthiest man in the world, Jeff Bezos. He's the king of retail and a master of technology, joining forces with the king of Wall Street and the Oracle of Omaha, who himself is an insurance giant. So these 3 are masters of the corporate universe, but they too detest spiking healthcare costs. Buffett himself calls it a hungry tapeworm on Americans. And if you just look at the pie, healthcare spending represented 18% of our economy last year, far more than other developed nations. So there's a huge target on its back.
And they're looking at the moment at dealing with their own 1.1 million employees. Is the idea that in the future other companies could join in on this collaboration?
That's right. I mean, the cost between the time suck and the out-of-pocket that HR managers and employee face and the productivity hit, it's just so real. And you look at the massive profits of the healthcare sector and the huge amount of waste. There's a Bloomberg study that said 20% of medical care was unneeded, about a quarter of tests and a fifth of prescriptions. So if you're someone like Jeff Bezos or Berkshire Hathaway and Warren Buffett, and you're not necessarily being profit-minded, at least an enormous opportunity cost to address.
Who is not happy about this news today? What companies are saying, uh-oh, this is going to be a problem for us?
You look at any healthcare company writ large on the markets today, from United Health, which is getting clobbered, the enormous insurer, CVS, which is shacking up with Aetna, the drug makers, Pfizer, Merck. I mean, it reminds me of all manner of supermarket and retailer stocks tanking a year ago when Amazon took out Whole Foods and blindsided the world. It's like Jeff Bezos is coming for you, man.
Well, you mentioned the markets, Robin. We've been watching the stock market today, and it's doing something unusual, at least in recent days, which is it's been dropping quite a bit, down as much as 400 points on the Dow today. What's going on there?
Yeah, Daddy, what's a sell-off? I'm waiting for my son to ask you that. I just don't know. We haven't had that feeling, that spirit here since 2011. But, you know, we came out of the gate and I think had the best January in a long time on a kind of mundane level. It's a bit of the pause that refreshes. The biggest capitalized company in the entire market, Apple, has had some underwhelming news, which has kind of dragged down the Dow and the S&P 500. But it's not helping today that the enormous likes of United Health and Pfizer and CVS are getting clobbered.
Well, and I'm also seeing that there are concerns about interest rates going up around the world.
Yes, you have seen a creep up in interest rates. I mean, heaven forbid, the 10-year is going to break 3%. The horror, the horror. Get Paul Volcker out or something. I mean, you know, we've gotten so used to unnaturally low interest rates for so long that anytime you get any hint of anything like a taper tantrum, people are going to sell first and ask questions later.
So you're saying don't panic.
I mean, maybe it's a crying wolf type thing, and we've been inured to this stuff happening. But every year has started with people saying, this is going to be the bond bloodbath, and it's never happened.
Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure on NPR One. Thank you, as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Current legal limit for blood alcohol concentration, or BAC, when driving is 0.08. But a new study from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine says it should be lower, 0.05. Supporters say it's about time. The National Transportation Safety Board recommended that in 2013. Critics say it's too tough. Tim Namey is one of the authors. He's also a doctor at Boston Medical Center. Tim, tell us more about why this study was commissioned and how you got to this recommendation.
Unfortunately, the number of alcohol-related crash deaths in the U.S. has plateaued for some time. I think a lot of people thought, oh, drunk driving is sort of a thing of the past, but it's not the case. Yeah. There's a number of things that we evaluated, and one of them, as you mentioned, was reducing the BAC limits from 0.08 to 0.05. Most people in the developed world live with 0.05 laws or lower. Most of the evidence is pretty firm that 0.05 laws save lives and probably could reduce the number of deaths each year by about 10%.
Well, but do I understand that would be, and again, it varies body type,
sure,
and people's ability to take in alcohol.
Yeah.
But in general, that is said to be one glass of wine for a woman and maybe two beers for the average man?
Well, like you said, it varies a lot from person to person. It depends on the size of the drink. It depends how fast that the drink is consumed. It depends on your sex, and it depends on your body mass. And I would also say, Robin, that regardless of whatever the legal limit is, the best advice is, you know, it's good not to drink and drive.
I'm going to jump in and say some of us will never, ever, ever get in a car, even with half a glass of any kind of alcohol. It just is just a bottom line. You don't
right.
get in the car.
Right.
But one glass of wine or two beers, to some people, that sounds like what, you know, a night out for dinner. So
sure. Well, I think I'm going to push back a little bit on your sort of generalization that it's a glass of wine. So even for a woman who's only 100 pounds, for example, who drinks a standard drink very quickly, say within 15 or 20 minutes, usually their BAC will top out around 0.04. For a more typical sized woman, it would take sort of two drinks to reach 0.05, and for a typical sized man, it would take three drinks to reach 0.05. And again, I'm just talking in generalities. So I think it's good to know that for most people, if they go and they decide that they are comfortable drinking something and then driving, and they feel certain that they're not impaired, that it's, you know, pretty unlikely that somebody's going to have a beer or a glass of wine and is going to end up arrested for DUI.
Okay, we'll make it two. It's sounding like you're really trying to point out that may be the social norm, but you may be impaired.
That's correct. Again, I'm sympathetic to people who go out and who drink, but the point is it's incumbent on all of us, since it's not only their own safety, but remember that about almost half of all people who die in impaired driving crashes are actually not the drinking driver. Again, in general, it's incumbent on all of us that if we are drinking, that we either not drive or that we make sure that we're not putting ourselves or perhaps more importantly, other people at risk. The risk of a crash starts to go up at about 0.02. And by the time you're at 0.05, your risk of a crash is increased severalfold.
Well, this might be a wake-up call for some people. But as you well know, there are people saying, hey, why not just do 0.0? You can never drive after having had something to drink, which some people say they're doing anyway. And mm-hmm. that's where other parts of your report come in, because you seem to be saying that society needs to do more to support people who maybe want to go out and have a couple drinks and then need to get home. You say there should be more alternative transportation, more sobriety checkpoints to check on people. What are some of the other recommendations?
Yeah, I think there's a number of recommendations in the report. The first thing I think we did that's important is recognize that when it comes to impaired driving, it's both a drinking issue and a driving issue. And, you know, you've been talking about, well, what if you have two or three drinks? Well, the fact is that most people who drink and drive have had, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 drinks. So that's something we can definitely work on. Some of the ways to do that are by things like raising alcohol taxes, by preventing people who sell alcohol, selling to people who are already intoxicated. That's against the law, but those laws are very rarely enforced. And then on the driving side, we absolutely agree that 0.05 is just one of a number of recommendations we had. Now, a lot of people are interested in new technologies. One of them is something called ignition interlocks. So ignition interlocks are devices for people who have DUI offenses, and it basically makes them blow into a sort of a breathalyzer before they can start their car. A number of states now have interlock laws, but our key recommendation is that people should be required to have interlocks even for a first DUI offense. Usually, people are only even stopped for DUI once every 100 or 200 times that they do it. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, it's actually, unfortunately, pretty tough to get caught. So if you wait till somebody has multiple convictions for DUI, then you're going to be missing things. And even as it is, more than half of people who die in drunk driving crashes, the culpable driver has never been convicted of a DUI.
And has probably driven quite a bit.
And then the other thing is, Robin, we don't want to just sort of focus on, you know, the interlocks. We also want people who have drinking problems to be able to get help and get access to treatment.
Well, staying with technology, yeah. Some people might say, look, my car is so smart. Why not have impairment detection devices for everybody?
I think that's a very promising area. We can't know for sure it's going to be effective because it hasn't been done yet. But there's a system called the DAD system, and I never can come up with the acronym
properly. I happen to have it here, Driver Alcohol Detection System for Safety.
Perfect. Yeah. So that's, in a way, is sort of like an interlock device, except it's a passive system that could be in any car. And that can be based on what's in the air or can be based on a transcutaneous system where you know, now when you start your car with the push of a button, it can measure alcohol levels. Now, there are ways to defeat that technology, just as there are ways to defeat license suspensions and interlocks. But what the committee hopes is that once that technology is accurate and once the price is comparable to other things like seatbelts and airbags, that those devices be made mandatory safety equipment in all new cars.
That's Dr. Tim Namy, physician at Boston Medical Center, one of the authors of the study from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, recommendations for curbing alcohol-impaired fatalities on the road. Tim, thanks.
Thank you, Robin.
And by the way, at hearnow.org, we'll have a graph for you. The state of Texas put it together. You can see, according to your weight, how many drinks it would take before you're impaired at 0.05. That's at hearnow.org. News now from baseball. Starting with the 2019 season, the Cleveland Indians will no longer use Chief Wahoo as a logo on uniforms or in the team's stadium. The team and Major League Baseball made the announcement yesterday. The character has long been both a cherished part of the team's identity for some and offensive to others, and the team said it's no longer appropriate. Matt Richman from WCPN IdeaStream reports.
The logo is a red-faced caricature of a Native American with a big grin and a single red feather standing up from the back of his head. Team members wear the logo as a patch on their uniform sleeve. MLB.com columnist Joe Posnanski says for 77 years, it's been the team's only logo, adorning hats, jerseys, and merchandise.
There used to be actually a giant Chief Wahoo on top of Cleveland Municipal Stadium, and because of this, he has become associated in a deep, deep way with Cleveland Indians baseball.
A campaign to do away with Chief Wahoo began in the 1990s when the team was one of the best in baseball and in the national spotlight. In recent years, management started using a block red letter C more and more as its main logo. Every year, critics would protest Chief Wahoo outside the stadium at the home opener, while some fans show up in face paint and feather headdresses. Philip Yenyo is executive director of the American Indian Movement of Ohio. He applauds the decision, but says why wait? Chief Wahoo won't officially be retired until the start of the 2019 season. And Yenyo says the team should take the next step and drop the name Indian too.
I mean, it's if the team was called the Cleveland Negroes and people went down to the ballpark dressed in blackface, how well do you think that would go over?
Baseball officials say the team name will not change, and many fans in Cleveland aren't likely to give up Chief Wahoo either. Official merchandise can still include the logo. Fans can still bring the caricature into stadiums during games. The team's main fan club, the Wahoo Club, is 56 years old. Club president Bob Rosen says, sure, some fans aren't happy about the announcement, but...
if the Indians do away with Chief Wahoo and they have another 22-game win streak and they make the playoffs again and this, that, and the other, all will be well with the world.
Rosen says he'd even change the club's name if that's what the team wants. For Here and Now, I'm Matt Richmond in Cleveland.
CIA Director Mike Pompeo says he expects Russia will try to disrupt the midterm elections later this year. Pompeo spoke to the BBC at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia.
Of course, I have every expectation that they will continue to try and do that. But I'm confident that America will be able to have a free and fair election that will push back in a way that is sufficiently robust that the impact they have on our election won't be great.
Joining us now is BBC security correspondent Gordon Carrera, who interviewed the CIA director. He's in Washington. Gordon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
And you also asked Pompeo whether he had to walk a fine line with President Trump, who has described possible collusion with Russia as fake news. How did he answer that question?
Well, he said he didn't do fine lines. He said he simply did the truth, and he would brief the president every morning on what he considered to be the truth. I thought it was interesting that he was quite willing to talk about Russia, Russian interference, about the continued risks of Russian interference, saying that he hadn't seen any decrease in Russian activity over the last year or two in both the United States and Europe when it comes to that kind of subversion and interference.
And did he tell you whether the U.S. will do a better job in stopping Russian interference in the upcoming elections?
Well, it was interesting because he did talk in a bit more detail about the kind of techniques which might be used to stop that. Now, he was careful not to be too specific. He did talk about, you know, one section of activity which he said wasn't the job of the CIA, which was about educating people about sources of information. But then he did talk in slightly general terms, but still interestingly, about trying to deter Russian activity, about trying to use intelligence to identify those people in Moscow behind it, and trying to use an array of tools, technical tools sometimes, to stop it, and also to try and communicate to Russia that it wasn't in their interest to pursue such activity. So he certainly implied that there were things going on behind the scenes, obviously, to try and stop continued interference.
All right, let's listen to another clip from your interview. This is Pompeo talking about the threat China poses when it comes to covert influence.
We can watch very focused efforts to steal American information, to infiltrate the United States with spies, with people who are going to work on behalf of the Chinese government against America.
He's saying there that China poses just as big a threat as Russia when it comes to cyber attacks and espionage, maybe even a bigger threat.
Yes, I think that surprised me, actually, that answer, and that he wanted to be so forward-leaning on China, saying, yes, it was in some ways a bigger threat than Russia. And when I asked him why, he said partly because the Chinese economy gave it more influence. And I think what he was saying is, if you think about Russian interference, it's been about hacking, it's been about the use of social media. That's where the allegations have centered. I think with China, he was saying something slightly different. He was saying that there is, if you like, espionage, there's traditional spying, there's also intellectual property theft, but there is also the way in which China can use its economy, its companies, for influence, for sometimes covert influence. And it can use, for instance, access to the Chinese market as a means of pressuring US companies to do certain things. And so I think he was talking a much broader sense in which China has the ability to exercise influence around the world, in some ways more than Russia.
He also talked to you about North Korea, and he seemed to say that time is running out for diplomacy with Kim Jong-un. Here's another clip from the interview.
We talk about him having the ability to deliver a nuclear weapon to the United States in a matter of a handful of months.
What's your read on how the CIA is handling or is involved with this threat under Pompeo?
Well, he was saying that the role of the CIA is partly to provide intelligence on that time scale, so to try and understand how much time there is left for diplomacy to run. But he was also clear that at that point where the sense in Washington is that the time has run out for diplomacy, part of his job at the CIA will be to provide intelligence and options for non-diplomatic means of dealing with the crisis, as he put it. And I said, well, does that mean, do you think there is a, do you think it's possible, for instance, to somehow take out Kim Jong-un or to take out his ability to launch missiles? And he simply said, many things are possible. And we discussed the kind of huge implications of a full military conflict, given the enormous loss of life that were result of in that, particularly in South Korea. And he said, officials were mindful of that, but clearly there is a sense in which the CIA is looking at all the possible options beyond diplomacy as well as supporting that diplomacy.
Gordon Carrera, you say that the CIA under Mike Pompeo won't be shy about taking risks. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that was the sense I got from talking to him, was that he wanted a more forward-leaning CIA. I think he was deliberately partly drawing a contrast with his predecessor, John Brennan, who was sometimes cautious about saying that the CIA was in the business of stealing secrets. And Mike Pompeo was very keen to say, no, we go out there, we steal secrets. And I think he wants to create a sense that this is an agency which in some ways has been unleashed, unburdened. And I think in many ways the CIA is an arm of the president, and it reflects the president it serves. And I think Mike Pompeo is clearly trying to do that under Donald Trump.
That's BBC security correspondent Gordon Carrera in Washington. We'll link you to more of his interview with CIA Director Mike Pompeo at hereandnow.org. Gordon, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.